2022 Aquatic Invasive Species Management Plan. Jake, you doing that one?
Yes, sir.
Welcome. Good morning.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the Commission, Secretary Roebling, Jake Davis, Fisheries Program Administrator. And this morning, we're going to start out discussing aquatic invasive species, and more specifically, the 2023 GFP Strategic AIS Plan. So the topic I'll be sharing with you this morning will also go out to the public for public comment period, and we'll have it in front of you again in January. Yeah, thanks, buddy. So before we start into the plan content itself, one thing I do want to discuss in general is just, it's easy to look at AIS in South Dakota, but there's certainly a story to be told before any of these species came to our state. And with that, I just want to cover that. So for folks that are maybe listening or aren't aware, aquatic invasive species are plants and animals, organisms that are introduced into environments that they're not native to, and they can have effects on ecosystems and the users of those. So in North America, for example, aquatic invasive species, they continue to be introduced. We continue to see new species. And additionally, species that have already been introduced have continued to spread. The example I'm going to use is zebra mussels. This is a species that certainly has had a lot of coverage lately in South Dakota, but prior to that, there was a lot of coverage in North America, to be quite honest. The data I'm going to be using here is U.S. Geological Survey data. And what you'll see here is a map of essentially continental U.S., Canada, and you'll see two dots there. That's the initial detection in the Great Lakes in 1986. That vertical red line there is meant to essentially be the western boundary. So we're just going to kind of take a few time-lapse photos, if you will, and see how the distribution has changed. So this was 1986. We fast forward to 1996. In cases here, we have a lot more detections in a lot of different states and provinces, and that western border has essentially moved west. Now, an important thing to note about zebra mussels is they really have no method to move on their own. They have a small foot. They can move very short distances, but in general, the way that they're transported is downstream dispersal of their juveniles, their reproductive, the juvenile stage is free-floating, or essentially another vector, which in a lot of cases is watercraft transport. So this is 1996. We fast forward to 2016. That western boundary is now essentially the Missouri River in South Dakota and north and south, but you can see that we do have some outliers all the way out to California. And additionally, in the areas that they were established, that spread has continued, and basically all the way from Canada down to Texas. So if we fast forward to 2022, again, now that western boundary is pushed to the western side of Colorado, and that the red dots, that distribution where they currently were, has expanded as well. So just again, painting that picture of what AIS has done before it came to South Dakota, and for reference, zebra mussels were first detected in the state in 2014. Now, as far as focusing in on the Midwest itself, this graph here is just showing some of our neighboring states that have zebra mussels. And going back to 2015, and really the takeaway here is that these are new infestations every year, essentially. So the bar graphs that you're seeing are new waters that are detected with zebra mussels in a given year. The key takeaway here is that essentially in every state that had them, they continue to have new detections. Now, another important thing to note about these states, they all have aquatic invasive species programs. However, the levels of approach that they use, and additionally, the levels of financial expenditures that they essentially put towards AIS, it differs between each state. But in some cases, it can be millions of dollars. And so the take home here is that in all those cases, we still see new infestations in each state on an annual basis. Again, that continued spread wherever that distribution is. So we've talked about AIS in North America. We've talked about AIS in the Midwest. Let's focus in on South Dakota. Currently, in administrative rule, codified law, we have 13 fish species, 8 plants, and 8 invertebrates that are listed as aquatic invasive species. Not all of these are actually present in the state. Some are just within close proximity or considered a threat. The reason that we list them is that's one of the efforts to prevent them or slow them from coming here is that people can't legally possess them then. So again, not all of these species here that are listed or in rule are actually in the state currently. But the ones that are present in 48 waters within the state. Some waters have one, some have multiple AIS within. Basically, what it comes down to is the surface water of the state, there's a lot of different users out there. They're used in a lot of different ways. In the end, it comes down to the responsibility of each surface water user. So that's going to be one of our big take-home points that we're going to hit on with this plan and talk about this morning. And our message, to be very frank, very simple, clean, drain, dry. That's what we've been trying to push for a number of years, and we're not the only ones that are doing that. But essentially, if you're following clean, drain, dry, this applies to all aquatic invasive species, and you're really just doing the things necessary to take actions on your own to slow the spread. One of the things that we do look at for metrics is essentially pulling bolt plugs, anything that would allow water to be held in a watercraft. That's one vector for AIS to spread. One way that we do that is looking at compliance of that during our watercraft inspections. This year we had over 18,000 inspections, and on a statewide level, our compliance rate was 96%. That varied in certain inspection stations from 93 to 100%. But again, what we're seeing there is that increased compliance by users, hopefully slowing the spread because they're putting into practice best practices when they're using a water body of the state. There are some challenges with aquatic invasive species. South Dakota is very fortunate to have an abundance of aquatic resources, but I will say that it makes things challenging when we look at putting a program on the ground. When we look at our resources, again, very fortunate to have the number of resources that we have, but based on GIS information, we have almost 10,000 water bodies that are over 10 acres. And a lot of these water bodies are quite connected, especially in certain parts of the state like the Northeast where you have flowing waters that connect them. Additionally, we have close to 500 boat ramps that provide access to these water bodies within the state. Again, an abundance of resources, but it does make things challenging. We also have 11 primary entry points in the state, considering interstate and highway travel. Again, just a lot of access areas. So when we talk about our plans, and we've had a number over the years, when we look at what drives these plans, we take all of this into consideration. What's happened outside of South Dakota? What aquatic resources do we have? We have really used that to guide our program, and it has changed over the years as different AIS has come into the state as well. But just to give you a brief background on what plans have been there in the past, the first one was actually a statewide. It wasn't just specific to Game Fish and Parks. It was adopted in 2008. It allowed for us to apply for federal funding. So that was the first one in 2008. You'll notice it was called the ANS plan. We call it aquatic invasive species. In some cases in different state agencies, you'll see it as aquatic nuisance species, referring to the same thing. It's just a different way to call it, essentially. In 2016, there was a GFP-specific aquatic invasive species plan that was adopted by the commission. What we had in that was a lot of outreach and education. Additionally, we had SD Least Wanted that launch with that, so essentially a one-stop shop online. So that was our 2016 plan. Since then, we started annual communication plans in 21 and 22, and those will continue again. Those are focused annual plans describing how we are going to reach out to the users as best as we can. And then what we'll cover today is this 2023 strategic plan. So the items I'm going to discuss are essentially the objectives within the plan. Hopefully you guys had a chance to look at it. If not, it's certainly available and I believe been passed out. The big thing is outreach and education is continue to be our primary focus because, again, we're trying to reach every user of the state on all these different water bodies and all these different uses. With that, though, regulations enforcement are a large part of that. I do want to reference our plug compliance rate that we saw, but again, regulation and enforcement are certainly a part of the process. Detection and monitoring, it's important that we know what we have and where they are at. AIS research, how we support that within and outside the state. Our standard work activities, because certainly when you look at aquatics, we are on water bodies in the state frequently. And so we want to make sure that in our activities, whether that's raising fish, stocking fish, surveying fish, that we're not increasing the spread. And then additionally, our partnerships that we have internally, externally, really anywhere we can find them. So starting with our outreach and education, as I mentioned before, annual communication plans, and that will continue. The reason that we're doing annual is that every year is a little bit different. There's new tools and methodologies out there to reach people. Social media, for example, that's always a changing landscape. Additionally, there's new information that comes from the research side of things that we can incorporate. And also, as AIS evolves within our state, it changes the folks that we might be trying to target. Again, though, it has that simple message, clean, drain, dry. And we really use any media platform that we can internally. Media releases, emails, social media, Facebook, whatever that might be. Also, we have partnered with outside entities for certain aspects of reaching folks that we can't facilitate. Gas station TVs are an example. So we had staff put together a video, worked with another company, and that was shown on 43 gas station TVs around the state this summer. So hopefully when folks were filling up with gas before they hit the water, they saw that short video on AIS. And then we have our SD Least Wanted website. And our hard copy publication, such as an informational rack card, is going to have that website on there. It's going to have a QR code in a number of instances, signage that have this QR code to funnel people to that essentially one-stop shop for AIS information in the state. We also do very targeted communications. You can see here on the bottom right that image is specific to a new infestation at South Rush Lake from this summer. That was an email that went out, but again, very targeted versus just a generic message. This is going to say, folks, this is what we just detected. Be aware that this lake is now considered infested with zebra mussels. We've done peak time billboards, DOT, so the flashing billboard signs, pull your plug around July 4th, for example, and we expect to have a lot of watercraft traffic. We have informational rack cards we've distributed to Department of Revenue, which they have distributed to county treasurers, with the hopes that they're included with watercraft registrations on an annual basis. So again, maybe reaching folks that aren't necessarily anglers that we don't have contact for. Targeted messaging with lake associations. We send them a letter that have options on ways that they can partner with us, which includes a communication kit that they can distribute to their members. Specific groups like marina slip holders, so especially on marinas that have that are on infested waters, the boats that are there for a long period of time, very high probability of having mussels attached to them. There's specific communication that we've distributed to them specific to their situation. But then additionally, new infestations, we have a rapid response plan that essentially has timelines, matter of days for signage to be put up. Also, what communication steps are going to be taken within a matter of days, hours, and then who's going to be part of that. So that's our outreach and education. Moving on to regulations and enforcement. We use this again as a tool to help slow the spread. They also are meant to reinforce that clean, drain, dry. So those regs on pulling plugs, all that is to get users to that point of clean, drain, dry. We have those regulations in place, and the enforcement side is to help increase compliance. Now, enforcement in most cases happens at our watercraft inspection stations around the state. At any time this last summer, for example, 12 of those stations were being operated. Now, however, law enforcement staff does not have the ability to essentially be there all hours of operation. West, for example, we're looking at running 7 stations, 10 hours a day for 7 days a week. We just simply don't have the law enforcement capabilities to have staff there all the time. However, when they can be there, that helps with enforcement and compliance. And those watercraft inspections, again, we can't be everywhere all the time. This year we had our highest number, but that is an excellent chance for us to directly engage with users. For whatever reason, they're going to be on the water that day. Angling, recreating, whatever it might be, that's our chance to directly engage with them. And while going through and looking for AIS is important, the outreach and education standpoint is very important as well there. Detection and monitoring, as I mentioned before, knowing what we have and where it's at. We can utilize our internal staff. We conduct lake surveys all over the state. Our staff have the ability to look for AIS while they're out there. Additionally, we've got a lot of interested members of the public and folks that are right there. There's ways that we can actively engage them, and we have been, but there's citizen monitoring. We can distribute information as far as what to look for. We can actually distribute equipment that they can put out that AIS might attach to that they can use as a survey, essentially. And so looking at ways to engage the public to help us with our detection and monitoring. And then utilize our rapid response plan, essentially, if we have a new zebra or quagga mussel infestation, outlines exactly what we're going to do. We do support research on aquatic invasive species. For one thing, there's a lot that's happened outside of our state, and we certainly utilize that. If there's ways that we can contribute to that, we do. And again, we utilize what's outside. We also support AIS research in South Dakota. That can be done internally by our staff or through our state universities. In both cases, we've done both of this. What you can see, that bottom right image was essentially a review by a staff member out of Chamberlain looking at zebra mussels, their effects in South Dakota and specifics. And we have adjusted our methodologies as a result of that. For one instance, there was some work in neighboring states that indicated lakes with zebra mussels had higher mercury content in fish. We sample fish flesh annually, so we adjusted those samplings to waters that had zebra mussels for those fish species. Mentioned GFP standard activities, ways that we can make sure that we're not increasing the spread through our standard activities, because we do utilize waters of the state quite frequently. Raising and stocking of fish, certainly with the concern of blue dog being on an infested water body, the steps that are in place there to make sure that when we raise and stock fish out of that system, that we're not actually contributing to the spread of AIS in South Dakota. And additionally, field work, standard lake surveys, whatever it might be, watercraft are on multiple water bodies within a given period of time in the summer. The good thing is that we've got protocols in place. We can utilize what's been done in other states. We can utilize work that's been done within the state and essentially take some extra steps to make sure that we are not contributing to the spread, and really the risk is essentially negligible. And the last thing, the last one we'll cover in the plan, is partnerships. It's a big issue to tackle, so with that, we're looking to engage as many people, and we have been engaging as many people as we can. A lot of different groups, state agency partners, for example. DOT has been excellent as far as installing signs for us on infested water bodies, helping with billboards on the interstates during peak travel times, Department of Revenue distributing rack cards, tourism partnering with marketing campaigns and spreading the word, public safety as far as helping us determine locations for roadside inspections. Again, just a lot of partnerships within the state. We just had a call last week with state agencies again to talk about ways that we can increase those partnerships. Additionally, lake associations. Last year we reached out to 32 lake associations. We'll be doing that here in the coming weeks. We offer partnership opportunities, essentially just items that whatever fits best for that lake association depending on level of interest and things like that, but options they can take back as a group, discuss, and come back to us. And then other partners such as federal agencies, certainly say in Western South Dakota, partnering with Bureau of Reclamation, U.S. Forest Service, county conservation districts to help facilitate the program in Western South Dakota. Water development districts have provided funding, allowed for information dissemination, and then NGOs as well. But really, if you're willing to partner or talk, we are going to be at the table. So it's, again, a big issue and always looking for more partners. So some of the supplemental material that will either be included in this plan or be coming shortly. One is going to be the operational plan. So this strategic plan essentially outlines what the program is going to look like. This operational plan is going to be basically the day-to-day operations. This will be created on an annual basis, for example, because, again, the AIS is somewhat of an evolving topic. And so with that, the operational plan will be developed annually to help be more flexible. Letters to lake associations, again, annual efforts include a variety of partnership opportunities, if you will, and they can be tailored to specific scenarios, whatever lake association, what works best for them. We have a workforce recruitment plan that's included as an appendix in the strategic plan. The reason that we've got this is that was an issue last summer. We had a lot of vacant positions, and so that's going to be a big focus on us moving forward for 2023 is doing increased efforts to put bodies in those positions, essentially. The communication plan that I referenced, again, an annual plan to be more flexible. And then the rapid response plan that we did put into action with several infestations in 2022 and will be ready again in 2023. I did want to just mention impacts AIS as far as some of the things that are important for game, fish, and parks, fish species, and recreation. And it does get a lot of coverage and certainly in a lot of areas of the country. And I just want to let the staff here know and the commission that we do monitor our fish populations annually and, for example, our recreation or camping nights. So for start with fish populations, that's going to be the bottom right. This is Lewis and Clark Young of the Year walleye. So essentially walleye that were hatched in the spring and sampled in the fall. It's going to be their length. It's in millimeters, but essentially what you can picture there is a 5 to 6 inch walleye. We track that annually to see how big those fish are. Zebra mussels were established in 2015, and as you can see, there hasn't been any change as far as, there's always gonna be change between years, but it's still within the range we would expect. The reason we use this data is there was some information in Minnesota that indicated that young of the year walleye were smaller on average in zebra mussel infested waters. So we just wanted to show as an example here how we do look for that information. We use what we see outside the state and then apply it to the information we have available. We also do the same with recreational opportunities. So then you've got camping nights at Lewis and Clark Recreation Area. Again, zebra mussels established in 2015, and that what you see there essentially occupied camping nights there. And we have not seen an impact as far as less people going there because there's zebra mussels in the water. So I did want to just use those examples to show that we do monitor that, those metrics. And additionally, Lewis and Clark, one of our longest infested waters, might be a good one to look at. So AIS moving forward, focus on clean, drain, dry, implement this 23 strategic plan. We have the supplemental plans within that, the operational plan and communication plans are still being drafted. But it comes back to trying to change the behavior of every surface water user. We can't be everywhere all the time, so we try and provide those users with the tools that they need that they can implement best practices every time they use the water of the state. And that clean, drain, dry, just to show these are other neighboring states' AIS messages, and it's a pretty common theme. So with that, I'd take any questions.
Thanks, Jake. A great presentation, very timely. Anybody have any questions for Jake? Commissioner Bees.
Commissioner Bees here. How long are mussels in a, deeper mussels in a water body before they're detectable?
Sure. Through chair. So Commissioner Bees, it can kind of depend. In some cases, there's ways to monitor for the juveniles, for example, those free-floating veligers. A lot of times that's thought to be early detection. So when they're in that juvenile stage, you would sample with the water column. Problem is they're microscopic, and so those samples generally have to be sent off to a lab to be analyzed. One of the other problems is, in a lot of cases, adults are found, even if those juvenile tests come back negative, they're found to be with adults later on. So it's always kind of hard to tell. In most cases, you know, when you think about water transport, it's probably gonna be the juveniles that are transferred in that water. If you have a, say, a bilge tank or something, you pump lake water in, go to another lake, and then empty that tank, it's gonna be those veligers, those juveniles that are in there, and then it's gonna take a while for them to settle out and develop. But in some cases, it looks like we've got zebra mussels that are a year old or more when they are detected. So it's kind of an approach where you're looking for both, essentially, but you never know if you're actually gonna find it or not. For example, Pactola Reservoir, I believe the veliger samples, after we found an adult, the veliger samples came back, several were negative, several had, say, single numbers of veligers found, but I mean it's a little bit of a hit or miss game as well.
What other invasive species are on your radar that you might be thinking are coming to the state?
Yep, through the chair. So certainly the ones that we have listed, again, in variety of fish, plant, and invertebrate, but we have some that are certainly in the state, such as invasive carp, but are still restricted to certain areas due to barriers and rivers. Those are ones that we certainly don't want to see spread any farther. We've got some like New Zealand mud snail that we knew were in western states, but we hadn't detected them here. They were on the radar, and then we did find one detection several years ago. But really, I'd say it's all of them, and you just never know because of the way that they could move. When I showed that map, USGS data, that western line, but all of a sudden you had that one outlier in California. I mean, that's a big jump. So really anything that's within North America is potentially has the ability to get here if it's transported, unfortunately.
Mr. Whitmire.
Yeah, thank you, Jake. Commissioner Whitmire, on the, so 4% of the boats checked hadn't pulled their plug or what have you, so 700. Do you know how many of those people were fined? You know, you got volunteer stations. I'm assuming, you know, some of the volunteers can't assess a fine, but do you know how that works?
Right, through the chair. Yeah, so as I mentioned, we don't have law enforcement present all the time. Our staff members don't have the ability to write citations. So in most, and I believe this year we had several hundred citations and warnings written, but it certainly wasn't every time. So what we instruct them to do is correct the behavior. So for example, if somebody comes in with a plug or standing water in a live well at an inspection station, and there's no law enforcement present, what we would do is have that inspector essentially show the individual, the user, what's wrong, and then correct it with sponges, towels, whatever it might be. In fact, we have sponges that we hand out to users. So the idea is that, like, you show them what essentially is not up to regulation, and then correct it, and then in some cases provide them the tools that they can use moving forward.
Mr. Ristler.
Commissioner Ristler here. Jake, if an AIS is found in a body of water, what's the next steps then for the GFMP? Can they go in and try to eliminate them, slow the spread once they're in the water?
Through the chair. Yeah. Commissioner Ristler, so the steps that we have outlined, for example, in our rapid response plan, some of the main ones right away are going to be outreach and education. So within 2 days, signage will just be up for smaller signs. Within 5 days, our 4x8 signs will be up there. But then additionally, within, I believe, 24 hours, emails are going to be sent out to every contact that we can essentially get to. But when it comes to, say, eradication, it's going to depend on the species and then what's been attempted in other areas. For example, zebra mussels, there's very limited options. And the options that have been attempted in neighboring states such as Minnesota, Christmas Lake is a great example, they really weren't effective in the end. So, but it does depend on what that species might be. And it also, for some of them, it usually needs follow-up detection. So we might get one detection and the lake is then its suspect. Because if that's it, there have been cases where we've had water bodies in the state listed as suspect and then we never had a subsequent detection and they were no longer considered infested after that. But we still listed them as suspect, notified the public as best as we could, and then followed up with continued sampling.
Mr. Locken.
Yeah, Commissioner Locken here. Well, I was here clean, drain, dry. Is there an aspect there where we could be treating the boats? Like if down in the hull or something, bottom of the hull, is spots that are really hard to get dried out or drained, is there a bleach or a soap or something that those villagers can't tolerate that could be treated?
Through chair. Yeah. Commissioner Locken, there are ways that you can do that. And when I think of one, it's certainly maybe a different instance than your typical watercraft, but it was some barge equipment at Belfouche Reservoir, and we couldn't use hot water, for example, so it was a chlorine bath that we used to treat it, but those are 15,000-gallon tanks that we used, that we had to fill up. But there are ways to do that, and we also have different methods of a decontamination. So if somebody had, like, a watercraft coming out of Pactola that was in a slip and then was muscle fouled, if they were simply going to dry dock it all winter and have it freeze, that is a form of decontamination just because those mussels that are attached can't survive that. And really any of those AIS species aren't going to be able to do that. So, again, we do have different options that are available, and those were developed outside of South Dakota and are nationally accepted.
Yeah, Commissioner Locken again. one thing that's gotten real popular is those leaf blowers, those battery-operated leaf blowers, and they're pretty powerful. Are people looking at that to blow their blow the water out of the crevices and stuff like that on the boats, where they maybe can't get in with a sponge or something like that? And the other thing is the carpeted decks. Can villagers survive on where the boat sits on a carpeted deck? Will they survive in that carpeting from one lake to another?
To the chair, Commissioner Locken. So first part, as far as, say, a leaf blower or something like that, there are ways that you could suction water out with a shop vac or something. Again, usually the methodology that we try and provide all the users are going to include the hot water sprays going to a car wash that can provide water at 145 degrees, X number of days of dry time. So we do try to provide as many options as possible, and you're going to find that information on the information cards we hand out, sdleastwanted.com, whatever it might be. But we have a number of options out there that we tell people about. Now, as far as villagers and, say, wet carpeting, they can survive for a period of time in damp places such as live wells or whatever it might be. They are quite fragile in the end, but I don't want to say that if it was wet enough and wasn't stepped on that it couldn't potentially. You know, the question then is how it would get from there into the water, but that certainly would be a possible vector. There are other species that Could be moved in wet areas like that. It's the reason we don't allow felt soil to waders. There's some work saying that, say, something like a New Zealand mud snail might be able to be transported that way. So we do have some regulations in place for specific years just because of AIS concerns.
Thank you.
Commissioner Bartling.
Thank you, Chair. Commissioner Bartling, Jake, kind of being a devil's advocate here, this is going to come up in the legislative session. So I'm just thinking of a question that might come up. At your checkpoints, are the boats just checked as they're coming out of the water, or are they getting checked before they go in to make sure that there is no plug before that person goes?
Yep.
Comes.
Go ahead. Do Chair? No. Very fair question. And so the way that we actually run our program in the state, it differs between Eastern, Central, and Western South Dakota. In Eastern and Central South Dakota, with the high numbers of water bodies and access areas, we don't really run what we call an access-based program, which would be sitting at a boat ramp. We do in certain cases, say Enemy Swim Lake, and we partner with that lake association up there, or if we're able to get this roving crew hired this year for the Northeast and Eastern South Dakota, and that's more of a spot check to help with compliance. But in general, the way that we do it is a roadside inspection. The idea is that we set up on thoroughfares to maybe capture as many users going to cover essentially a number of lakes. So in that case there, it's all watercraft. If the inspection station is open, all watercraft are using, whether that's heading home from the water body or going to a water body. Now in Western South Dakota, they're generally entrance inspections because those water bodies essentially don't have many AIS. I'm not saying that they're free of them, but certainly when we look at, say, zebra mussels. So those are entrance boats coming into the water. It's more of a what we call a prevention approach. Now, once Pactola came back as infested, for example, zebra mussels, we spun those inspectors around and they caught traffic leading. Then we moved to a containment approach. So it does depend on location on the state, number of water bodies. And that's one thing Western South Dakota, too, very fewer access areas and lakes. And you think about just a handful of reservoirs. For example, Belle Fouche Reservoir, I believe it's 8,000 acres. We can cover all the ramps on it with one inspection station because there's one way in, one way out. So we are able to have a little different approach just with those scenarios.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Jake. And just to follow up for my own education, are the invasive species, are they more contained to a contained body of water versus a free flowing body of water such as the Missouri River, the Sioux River, James River? Are they more contained to a lake per se versus the river?
Through the Chair, so Commissioner Bartling, it depends on each species and their certain biology. For example, invasive carp need stretches of river for reproduction, so they do quite well in a riverine system. When you look at species like zebra quagga mussels, the way they reproduce and dispersal, their juveniles are distributing the water column. With a flowing water body, it moves them downstream, not upstream. In a lake, depending on winds or whatnot, it mixes differently, and so they spread differently. So each one is really going to be, you know, specific to a certain environment. Some do better in other environments than others, but it really is species specific.
Sorry, this is the legislator coming out in me. How many more people do we need to get a hold on this? Because I know like 500 boat ramps, 10,000 bodies of water. How you're going to get this from the legislature? Mm-hmm. What do you think, and maybe it's more for the secretary, but what do you think the biggest action point should be at this point in time to get a hold on some things?
Through Chair. Secretary Roblin, if you don't mind, I'll take a shot at this one. Yeah. But in all honesty, Commissioner Bartling, what we would need is that real easy answer is that 4%. Say we're at 96 compliance across the state, it's at other 4%. I mean, really it is. And it is a hard thing to maybe just say that we need everybody to do this. But when we look at neighboring states, and we can use these as examples, we look at neighboring states that have done different measures. And for example, when you talk about how many more people do we need, maybe it's being implied there that with all these boat ramps and all these different water bodies, we need people at all of them to make that effective. Well, we can look at other states that have done that approach and still observe spread. There are numbers of examples of water bodies that have mandatory entrance inspections because they didn't have, say, zebra mussels, closed gates outside of inspection time. So the idea is that nobody goes into that water body without being inspected. They still have detections. So really it comes down to every surface water user of the state every time. And that is a hard thing to discuss, but when we look at it, we are trying to provide tools so that everybody, when they go to water body, has that in their mind of what they need to do, their personal responsibility to address this issue.
Jake, there's a lot of folks that say we just have thrown our hands up and we've given up. We're waving the white flag, and I and the rest of us that have been involved in this since 2016 know, I mean, that's far from the case. What commitment of dollars are we going to put towards this effort in 2023? And, you know, you're going to hear people say, well, the state has more money than it's ever had. How come you can't just throw more money at it? If we just threw more money at it, could we stop it?
Mr. Chair, at least, again, this is using what we've seen in other states. Their examples, those millions of dollars of expenditures or numbers of inspections, there has not been a threshold found yet. We would look at some of our neighboring states that might spend upwards of $10 million on it, and that neighboring state that I'm referring to, for every one lake that South Dakota had infested this year, they had six. So, and they also had a lot more inspections and a lot more inspectors. So again, what I would say is there's no magic number for it. I'm sure there's a lot that could be thrown at it, but again, that magic number is the users and their compliance every time. I'm not sure if that answered the question or not, but again, it's a hard one to really answer to say that it's going to just take a certain dollar amount to make it work. I would say that we have not seen that yet.
Well, Commissioner Bartling hit on it, and obviously you guys are aware that, you know, starting in January, there's 105 experts coming to town that are going to already have an earful, and they've already got some people that I'm sure have a draft bill in hand. I would just suggest to the department that in those first weeks of the session, you find one of those breakout rooms and run through this exact presentation to educate them. Because if they're only hearing from the people that are saying we're not doing anything and not seeing that we do have a plan, we've been working on this, we've invested dollars, and that we're doing everything we can within reason, then you're going to spend a lot of time in committees fighting legislation or potential legislation that really, I think you guys could head off with some really good education up front. So thank you. Great presentation. Very, like I said, very timely. We appreciate all the work that you and the rest of the staff is doing on it, and keep up the good work. Secretary Roble.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Jake, for the great presentation. This is probably the fifth time I've seen it, and I learn something every time. So at the end of the day, I mean, I want the commissioners to take a good hard look at that strategic plan. There are, you know, some major things in there that we are looking to accomplish. One being is a recruitment campaign to get more people at these inspection stations. So right now we're actively recruiting college kids, retired folks, for seasonal labor, essentially, seasonal help here coming up for 2023. That's priority number one, to get those stations filled with people. The other component of this, though, is to continue a lot of what we have been doing. Our education outreach efforts have been very aggressive. I mean, Nick sends almost 2 million emails every year to our surface water users, and our open rates are good, our responses are good, we're seeing good compliance, you know, in regards to the boat plugs and things like that. But this is, it's like we're running uphill. It is, it's a frustrating endeavor. I know staff have worked tirelessly on these efforts time and time again, but we're far from being done. We now implemented a rapid response plan. So if we have an infested water body, we immediately get signs up, notification to the public, and the whole idea there is to contain the zebra mussels that we have in that body of water, keep them where they're at, slowing that spread. I'm very proud of staff for navigating through this. As you can see, we're not alone in this fight. I mean, the western, you know, push of zebra mussels continues to go west, and we are only here to slow them down, and that is exactly what we're trying to do, and that is what we have done since 2015. So we'll keep fighting the fight, and yes, we're looking forward to legislative session here and just having the opportunity to, you know, talk through things as we did here today. So thank you.
Thanks. That'll take us to number 23,